Blog Talk Radio.
Not exactly Blessed Souls, but this is in fact Soul Class 456 Secular by Design. It is now 9:01 live from Turtle Island, aka the USA, unifying souls actually. And we're listening to the Light in the Darkness from my brother in prayer, spirit and soul, Rev Isaac Gitton, the president of Beit Mazal from Kesakron Heights, Brooklyn, New York. And we're just going to let the song play out as we talk about today, focusing on the reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which you can make the wise decision by clicking on the following link at amazon.com/secular design philosophy noahide observances/dp/0977988538. Our call in number is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. Perhaps Alan might call in, perhaps not, but in the meantime we have Rambam, teacher and student and activist for the dissemination of teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Anesher Gadol, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don.
And I will start off with a little bit of humor. You know, my parents live in an adult living residence, and last Saturday night after the Shabbat, they had a performer who was Irish, and he mentioned that when he realized that the majority of the people in the adult residence were in fact Jewish, he said, "Well, I guess there are not too many Jewish people here, but I bet there's a lot of Ish people here." So my father responded, "Yeah, I'm nicht Irish," which Yiddish means I'm not Irish. But I guess today we're all a little bit Irish today, being it's St. Patrick's Day, and I guess we're all a little bit, if we're concerned about the land of Israel and the integrity and the protection of the Jewish people, hopefully, although I don't like to promote politics in any shape, form, or manner, I do hope that those who are elected will protect the integrity of the land, the integrity of the people, and to show strength to build coalitions, as Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke about a couple weeks ago at the joint session of Congress, because strength builds coalition, weakness invites the enemies to try to become even greater enemies. So Dennis, anything you'd like to reflect today, if you want to share with our blessed listening audience anything about St. Patrick's, because I really have no idea about who this man was.
Well, historians say he came from Spain, believe it or not.
Huh.
He was a big, tall, dark-haired guy, but the only place they could figure out where he came from was Spain. So who knew? So that just shows you the interchange of ethnic backgrounds and everything, especially here in the United States, and you mentioned that everybody's Irish today. Well, I only hope it's reciprocated for all the other ethnic groups that we have, because that's how we present ourselves as being unified.
True. And, of course, the Irish in the American experience went through their travails and have promoted and broken out. I think basically, I don't think Irish people here too have too much stigma, although I'm not Irish. Perhaps someone who's grown up as an Irish American would talk about being stigmatized at times, but certainly I know that when the mass migration started in the 19th century, I believe for Irish people coming from the mainland of Ireland, that they did encounter prejudice, but they had their belief in God and their faith, and they were able to overcome it.
Well, at least they had jobs when they came here, because somebody
yes.
had to dig out the subways.
True. My great-grandfather, I'll just mention in passing, whom is one half of my name, I am Don Zusia. The Zusia is named after my great-grandfather, may have blessed him, Zusia, who used to be a street cleaner on the streets of New York City. So when I sometimes I sweep up my congregation, my synagogue at the famous Franken Shul here in Kessett Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York, I just tell people, I'm just carrying on the tradition of my great-grandfather, Zusia. I'm just taking it to the next level. I'm trying to clean up a place where there's prayer and sanctity, where we can try to imbue the place with that type of experience. So let's now go, Dennis, and anyone listening in, you can call in at 347-838-8669. We're going to page 66 of Alan W. Cecil's book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. This section is called The Dark Side of Enlightenment. And we're going to start off with, I believe, someone who is no longer here on this living earth. And in fact, I think he was a Jewish man who lived out in England. And unfortunately, he was an atheist, which pains me to hear the association of any Jewish person with atheism. But such is the exile that we have experienced in the last 2,000 years that even Jews sometimes can fall into that trap of forgetting about the Creator. Christopher Hitchens echoed the sentiments of many modern intellectuals when he said that, quote-unquote, humanity began to grow up a little in the closing decades of the 18th century and the opening decades of the 19th. And this is from Hitchens' book. I don't want to say the title because I'm not allowed to say the title. It's page 66 from his book. I'll just say that. Alan said he can say it, but I can't say it. So if he comes on or a future presentation when we quote from Hitchens' book, we'll let Alan say it. So my first comment, and I'll look for your commentary on this, Dennis, is that humanity began to grow up a little in the closing decades of the 18th century, the opening decades of the 19th. Well, there was still plenty of slavery going on, and Napoleon had gone and taken the reins of the leadership in France with a lot of people getting slaughtered. So what type of humanity is Hitchens referring to about growing up?
Hello?
Yeah, Dennis. Did you hear my question?
Oh. Well, I think that's the wrong terms, growing up. I think a lot of people were evolving in thought, and they think that evolution of thought was making them smarter, wiser, and more informed. But that's not true at all. All they were doing was trying to find new ways of doing things. But if it's already been predefined, how many new things can you come up with when you're really going to go around in a circle? Because you can't reinvent God. You can't reinvent the creation. That's all in place. So what happens is some people call it enlightenment, that we were going to find new ways to understand our world. Well, they forgot that our world is shared with a spiritual part too. And in that spiritual part, the basis for that is God. So if you think you can come out with beautiful words in a language that shows you are free of the old ideas, you're mistaken. It's only a matter of time till you come full circle.
True. Now, Alan actually went on to elaborate what this was referring to, this idea of growing up of humanity, i.e., when, quote-unquote, enlightened secularism began its blitzkrieg, that's a pretty strong language, on organized religion, replacing the ethical teachings of the Bible with those of the, quote-unquote, enlightened philosophers. The political consequences of the French Enlightenment and the teachings of the philosophers such as Voltaire were a substantial influence that fueled the social turmoil which led to the French Revolution. Let me mention in parentheses, the French or the bloody French Revolution, and the Reign of Terror, as well as the subsequent rise of Napoleon and a brutal warfare that convulsed Europe for two decades. To a lesser extent, the ideas of the Enlightenment affected the colonies in America as well. Although the American Revolution was not nearly as bloody as the French Revolution, the conservative nature of the American Revolution was due to it being more over financial reasons rather than ethical ones. And then Dennis Allen mentioned in parentheses here in his book, although the French certainly did have it out for nobility and the upper class, the ethical Enlightenment philosophy such as freedom, liberty, and equality that so enamored the founding fathers of the United States, unfortunately did not seem to apply to people of different color. And this created tension between the slaveholding South and the North, later on which would indeed result in more bloodshed during the Civil War. In fact, many of the founding fathers of the United States owned slaves, such as, and I was not aware of this, Benjamin Franklin had owned slaves, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, and Thomas Jefferson, who penned the Declaration of Independence, not only owned over 100 human slaves, but on occasion used them to relieve his enlightened lust, as proved by the DNA sampling of Sally Hemings' descendants. George Washington, the first president of the United States, had three times as many slaves as did Jefferson, and there were few rumors about his cavorting with his black female slaves as well. As with Athens and Rome, a good port of the economy of 18th century United States depended on a large slave population, and the Constitution itself had a clause which stated that black slaves were only 3/5 of a person. The attitude towards the Native Americans was also a black spot on the early white settlers, for most Americans considered them barbarians and savages. There were, however, another difference between America and Europe. The puritanical streak in America created a climate where the Jews prospered. The small number of Jews who were part of the generation of the Revolution were accepted as equals almost everywhere. And this is quoted from Gray's Bell's History of the Jews, page 615. It was this puritanical strain that made all the difference a century later, when at the close of the 19th century, the anti-Semitism of Europe that had therefore up until that point been bottled up and suddenly exploded with renewed vigor and venom, and did not affect America to the extent or to the degree that it did in Europe. Dennis, any comments on this?
Yeah, well, it gets a little complicated, even though Alan is using some words that cover long periods of time as though they're condensed. What happened was, in those days, is that most people were against the upper classes. And it just so happened that most people who were of high religious places were in bed with the upper class of the nobility. So if you were against the nobility, you were against the established church institutions that were doing very well and had a lot of money, because there wasn't much difference between the upper class of the so-called religious people and the actual people who were rich and were nobility. And that's why we didn't have a clash here in this country, because we didn't have any nobility. And the church people that came were people who were being persecuted in Europe. So therefore, we didn't have a history of where the government and the upper class and the religious class were in bed together. So when the revolution occurred in Europe, it was people treated the upper class of the religious group just like the upper class of the nobility. So This carried forward, and when people were mad at the establishment, they didn't care who was there. Now, during this time, there were no Jewish establishments. There was no Jewish upper class. Jews remained as Jews unchanged. So therefore, people didn't distinguish as though they were the enemy or anything. So they were basically left alone because people were mad at the upper class and their groupings of upper class. So this went on for quite a while till the buildup occurred. And while this was going on, yes, people were using slaves, but they convinced themselves that they were really indentured servants. In other words, didn't have enough money to be the upper class, so they had to serve. So they came through and they invented some of these beautiful ideas as to why it's a good thing to have as many servants as you can. Now, that idea carried over from Europe, and that's why we had a lot of famous people when America began. They had servants because who was going to do the work? The upper class? No way. So we even had a colony that was full of indentured people. That was originally Georgia. But this didn't happen over a week or two. This happened over maybe a century or two. And it's strange how these things happened, but what we were missing during that whole period was moral fortitude. The moral part did not enter anything because people were making money. They thought things were going good. So therefore, they could look at life differently. What they forgot about was the basic values that were inherent in all human beings, and they decided to go off on their own.
True. Beautiful points, Dennis. Now, where I left off in the reading from page 67 in Secular by Design, Protocols of the Philosopher, in the subsection titled The Dark Light, Dark Side of the Enlightenment, Alan quoted from a author. He didn't give the first name, but the last name is McCobe, and the name of the book is called Antisemitism and Modernity, Innovation and Continuity, taken from page 51. And he brings out a very painful point, which in fact, unfortunately, affects too many Jews today in this world. But let me just read it, and then blessed listeners out there, you'll get the gist of what I'm trying to bring out here. So, Alan, quoting from McCobe's book, the case of Voltaire and other Enlightenment anti-Semites, such as Baron de Halbach and his circle, raises a very painful question. Why did anti-Semitism survive the Enlightenment? This great movement of rationalism and science and liberalism dazzled the Jews with the prospect of toleration and acceptance, and in the end, of prejudice and fanaticism. Many Jews welcomed the Enlightenment with delight and rushed to make their own intellectual contribution to it, such as from Solomon Maimon and Moses Mendelssohn, for example. I think Moses Mendelssohn was the one who started the Reform Rabbinical Movement, which is basically a movement that is slowly but surely petering out in the face of more and more Jews want to come back to their authentic Torah roots. Yet, that's my own parenthetical injection there, blessed those, because I'm an example of those as a Jew who was raised in Reformed and even less than Reformed environment, and today I'm trying to adhere to a Torah authentic culture. Yet, in the heart of the Enlightenment, though by no means pervading its entirety, was vicious hatred and denigration of the Jews and of their religion and culture. Even the greatest thinker of the Enlightenment, Immanuel Kant, was affected by this specifically Enlightenment contempt for the Jews, and that's quoting from Maccabi's Antisemitism and Modernity, Innovation and Continuity, page 51. Now, going further, in Alan's book, the British intellectuals followed the same pattern of Voltaire's antisemitism. The English writer and philosopher John Stuart Mill, who I remember from high school, and I think I learned something about him in college as well, who lived from 1806 until 1873, had an attitude towards Israel which was not unlike Voltaire's. And this is a quote from John Stuart Mill on Liberty and Other Essays, which was published by Oxford University Press in 1991, and Alan extracted out from page 55 of that book. And here we go. This is a quote from that book. The gospel always refers to a pre-existing morality and confines its precepts to the particulars in which morality was to be corrected or superseded by a wider and higher, expressing itself, moreover, in terms more general, often impossible to be interpreted literally, and possessing rather the impressiveness of poetry or eloquence than the precision on legislation. To extract from it a body of ethical doctrine has never been possible without eking it out from the Old Testament, that is, from a system elaborate indeed, but in many respects barbarous and intended only for a barbarous people. Now, before I turn to Dennis, I just want to mention that there's an inconsistency here in the intellectual reasoning of John Stuart Mill, because, number one, that on the one hand, he says that it's often impossible to be interpreted literally. Well, that's a very general statement, because there are various literal statements in the Torah. And he says often, but he doesn't give a percentage. For instance, you're supposed to love the Lord your God. You're supposed to love your neighbor like yourself. How else are you going to interpret that other than literally, which is one of the primary fundamental principles of the Torah, loving the Creator and loving your neighbor as you love yourself, because from the oral Torah tradition, when you love your neighbor as you love yourself, you love God's choice that person is your neighbor and you his. And yes, there are pieces, when translated into the English, have a poetic fragrance to it. And then he mentions about how there's the possessing rather the impressiveness and poetry or eloquence than the precision on legislation. Now, how would Mr. Mill know what preciseness or lack of preciseness there is on legislation when he couldn't even look at the original writings in the original context? Rather, he took an English translation, and he never looked at the oral Torah traditions, which have tons and tons and tons of elucidations on legislative matters, in matters between man and God, and between man and man, and between man and the land. And so therefore he boils it down to a very cheap and superficial conclusion. This is only intended for a barbarous people. Well, Alan concludes at the end of this page, and then we'll turn to Dennis for some commentary. After disparaging Israel and the ethics of the Torah, dismissing the Jews as barbarous, ignoring the wealth of moral and legal teachings of the Talmud, then Mill criticized Christianity for not having a workable and moral and legal system. Mill highlights one of the major flaws of Christian theology, namely its lack of a working system of ethics. Mill observed correctly that what ethical teachings of the New Testament contained was taken from the Torah. And from a historical viewpoint, from the original Christians, well, they were trying to follow the teachings of the Old Testament, because their assertion was, and Dennis, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that the New Testament was a continuation of the Old Testament, with the particularization of the assertion of who they thought was their Messiah.
That is correct, Don. But you got to remember, the so-called Enlightenment was putting emphasis on the human. And the human could enlighten everybody, because if they thought about it, they would come up with a better system. And that was an underlying factor, but it never proved out to be. And how far away can you get from the basic principles of right and wrong, etc.? So they would even use excuses like, it was written an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Oh, that's barbaric. But again, were they taking it literally, or should they have taken it figuratively? A lot of egos, and human egos, were involved in this Enlightenment. And unfortunately, a lot of Jewish intellects thought they could be part of this, because they thought this was an intellectual movement.
Right.
It wasn't. It was an exercise in ego of, we're building new countries, we need a good working government, we got to understand how we're going to live. Instead of understanding what was previously done, they picked up a lot of Greek ideas. And that is that if we think about it, it is. All of a sudden, their egos started coming out, and they de-emphasized everything else by doing that. So what was established and what had been in existence for millennium, they ignored, because they said, wait a minute, I could think of a better way of putting this whole thing together? Well, again, intellectuals in Judaism sort of jumped in a bit and said, well, wait a minute, you want to be intellectual? We're intellectual. And that caused problems here and there because they didn't know how to pick and choose when it was all laid out for them thousands of years earlier. True. So by thinking that the Greeks invented a whole new way of thinking was misleading. So they started going back and saying, wait a minute, who's putting restrictions on my ego, on my enlightenment? And they blamed those people that used those original ideas from earlier in history, and nobody ever found anything wrong with them, so they weren't broken. What they did was they basically ignored them because they said, our new ideas are creative, innovative, and we're going forward. We're not going to be stuck in history. Well, that's ego talk. Why? Because if you didn't understand history, you're going to miss a lot of stuff that humans established for millennium that was proven to be true over and over. So the Jewish people and a certain amount of the Christians said, we don't need this because we're following what was established a long time ago, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's why you heard in the stuff you quoted, oh, it's restrictive, it ignores this and that and everything. Why? Because you thought of something new, so therefore it is? And that was a lot of their reasoning, as right. opposed to saying, wait a minute, we have moral obligations, we have moral responsibilities, and they emphasized that the principle, the human principle, was far more important than any spiritual concept.
True. With that being said, Dennis, I'd like to thank you for spending almost the last half hour with me, and hopefully we'll reunite this coming Sunday in Search of Ancient Authentic Torah with that series. And because you just took the past half hour, which is time is one of the most valuable resources of a human being, aside from their love and fear and complete faith in the Creator. So thank you very much for joining us, Dennis. Would you like to give one more comment just to leave our blessed listeners, whether listening live or the future archive version, a little tidbit, a little nugget of wisdom to take and empower them for the rest of the day after they've heard this broadcast or will hear it in the future?
Okay, Don, sounds good.
No, I'm saying, would you like to leave our listeners with a little nugget of wisdom to take with them to help empower them carry out their activities for today if they're listening to the live version or in the future in the archive version?
Based on the subject we were just discussing, Don, that is, there are no new problems. You just haven't resolved the old problems because you're relabeling it, retagging it. The new problems are a return to the old problems that you did not solve.
Beautiful. That being said, blessed souls, we're going to conclude. I'd like to thank Dennis Ryan for coming on today. I think it was a fertile almost 30 minutes. We're now going to conclude with our segue ending show music. David Dome will help us get back home to help us realize that we can internalize the Torah axiomatic teaching that we all have a Tzelem Elokim, a divine image, which is no dream, will help us get off in scrimmage. And to learn more about that, go to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 27. This is In the Now by David Dome. But before we say ciao, ciao, I just want to remind everyone, you can do good. You have that ability. You've been extracted out of the godly realms of the creation because the Creator wants you to be in the world. And a teva tov lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good. And this should be all carried out in a way of ahav achad, one love, goral achad, one destiny, come on for all of us. Bedarchi shalom, in a peaceful, darchi nom, in a pleasant way, to be lahamshich, bez Hashem yisperek, to be continued with the help of the Most High Creator. Take care, everyone.
Day. The people you knew and the places you've seen. If you've been hungover and you've broken a heart, we all have our very own place to start. There ain't no one who hasn't done anything wrong. Now's your chance to make it all turn out just right. Or will you put up a fight? Are the words sticking in? Will you put up a fight? Are the words sticking in? I've lived on both sides of the road. The one in the sun and the one in the the contrast is as clear as black on white. I've seen better in the light. Don't cling on to all your past misdemeanors. The past is done, what matters is where you are.
Living it now, that's what to do.